Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we go way back in the archives to 1997 for a conversation I had with screenwriter Walter Bernstein. Bernstein died last week at the age of 101 years of age. He was nominated for an Oscar for his 1976 screenplay, The Front, which starred Woody Allen and played on events from his own life. As the writer was working on early television dramas Danger and Studio One, when he was told he could no longer work in film or television, he was blacklisted all through the 1950s for his flirtations with communism in the 1930s. Through the 1950s, he worked under a series of pseudonyms or fronts where other writers would claim credit for his work. Among the television programs he worked on was Walter Cronkite's You Were There, which reenacted great moments in history. Eventually, by 1960, he was able to write again under his own name, starting with a Sophia Loren film, That Kind of Woman, and an uncredited work on The Magnificent Seven. He later wrote the screenplays for Paris Blues, Failsafe, The Molly Maguires, Yanks, Semi-Tough, and Little Miss Marker, which he also directed. He continued to work into his 90s, writing the script for HBO's Miss Evers Boys and the BBC miniseries Hidden, and teaching at the NYU Tisch School for the Arts. I spoke with Bernstein back in 1997 upon the publication of his memoir, Inside Out, A Memoir of the Blacklist. We'll repeat that conversation today on Studio Tulsa.
Walter Bernstein, we welcome you to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
As a young man, you write in your book, Inside Out, of growing up on movies. I think you write it, the screen knew the secrets of your heart. In fact, you describe your adolescence as much through movies, the movies you saw, as anything else. Was that always what you wanted to do, was be in the movie business?
Well, I wanted to be connected to movies in some way. And I wasn't quite sure when I was growing up. I knew I had always wanted to be a writer, but when I was growing up, writing for movies was considered kind of disreputable. I mean, you went to Hollywood and sold out, and if you were a real writer, you would write novels or plays or short stories or poems, things like that. But secretly, I always wanted to have something to do with movies, and since I was a writer, I thought, well, you know, it'd be great to write for movies. But I didn't start that way.
Yeah. You started out writing journalism and also pieces, I believe, for The New Yorker, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
After the war, you came home, went to Hollywood. How soon did the anti-communism movement within, say, the creative arts begin manifesting itself?
Well, let's see. I think the Hollywood Ten were called in 1947. It was quite soon after the war. And that kind of started the whole thing, although it had been started before that. It had been started really by the Democrats, by Truman, with the Truman Doctrine, and the Attorney General compiled a list of so-called subversive organizations. So it started very quickly after the war. The Russians changed very quickly from being our ally to being our enemy. And, the whole Red Hunt started.
Did it affect you in your work at the beginning, right after the war, when you first went to Hollywood?
No. Uh-huh. I got out of the Army after close to 5 years, and I went back to work initially for The New Yorker, and I had a book published of pieces I had written during the war that had mostly had been published in The New Yorker, war pieces. And on the basis of that, I got a contract to go to Hollywood, and I went out for 6 months. And the Blacklist hadn't started. I had a very good time there and worked on a couple of films, one called All the King's Men.
Mm-hmm.
And
very good film.
And then, yeah, and then I came back. I had a wife and a couple of kids here, and I came back to New York and got into live television, which was just starting. And that's when the Blacklist really began.
How did you realize that you had become a part of the blacklisted community?
Well, I was writing a show called Danger, which was a half-hour melodrama that had initially been directed by Yul Brynner and produced by Martin Ritt, who later became a director. And then they left, Yul very reluctantly, to take a part in this show that he had no high hopes for, and he thought the part was kind of foolish, which turned out to be The King and I. And Sidney Lumet became the director, and N.A. Charles Russell was the producer, and I was working for them very happily. It was a half-hour dramatic show at CBS. And I came in one day, and Russell said to me, "I can't hire you anymore." And I said, "Well, why not?" He said, "Well, you're on some kind of list, but I'm not supposed to tell you that. I'm just supposed to say, well, we're changing the style of the show. We need different kinds of writers." And he was taking a big risk doing that. He was not a political fellow at all, and he just thought it was terrible what was, you know, happening. And I knew what list I was on. There was some ex-FBI men had put out a booklet called Red Channels, which was a collection of about 150 names of people in the entertainment industry, actors, writers, directors, musicians, with a listing of their so-called left-wing or communist or communist-affiliated organizations that they had supported or belonged to. And if you were in Red Channels, you were automatically blacklisted, unless you went and cleared yourself. And I was in it. As a matter of fact, I remember I came right after Lenny Bernstein. And there were about 8 listings for me, all of them true. I had supported the Spanish loyalists. I had Russian war relief and something called the Civil Rights Congress, which was a communist-inspired or supported organization. I'd written for communist publications. And now that was the list I was on. And after that, I was blacklisted.
How did the blacklist actually work? You've kind of explained it, but I mean, really, I've heard of the Syracuse grocer that wielded incredible influence through the American Legion. This was just one guy who owned a grocery store.
Yeah,
in Syracuse, New York.
Yeah,
Tell us about how that really worked.
Well, in his particular case, he was a very rabid anti-communist, and he had 3 supermarkets in the Syracuse area, and he would put up a sign, say, where Borden's milk was sold, and he would say, "Borden, this company supports communist actors on their show, on their television show, and if you buy their product, you'll be supporting communism." And he just scared the networks, and he came down, had meetings at CBS that I knew about, and they would submit cast lists to him for his approval. And this was just one guy with 3 supermarkets. Otherwise, you know, if you were named by a congressional committee or one of this in Red Channels, or that's how you got blacklisted.
It was kind of a racket, too, because people made money off getting your name off the list.
Oh, yeah, sure. Right. They would name you, and they had there was an organization called AWARE, and they published a little magazine called Counterattack, in which they'd list shows and people they thought were communists on this show, or they accused. And you would be blacklisted if they named you unless you went and cleared yourself, and then they offered themselves as a clearing service. You paid them, and you went there and recanted, or whatever they asked you to do, and which always included naming names, naming other people. And then you got cleared. So it was really, you know, what I say in the book, was a protection racket.
When Charles Russell told you couldn't work under your own name, describe your thoughts at this time. I'm sure a part of you said, you know, if I go before this committee, you know, I can work again. Mm-hmm. And obviously the other side, which you obviously took, was, you know, I'm going to fight this and work around it. How did you work around it? And tell us about the decision to not testify and to not name names.
Well, they made it relatively easy for me, in that sense, because they insisted that you name names. I mean, it wasn't enough to go and say, hey, you know, I was a communist, and I'm not a communist anymore. I don't believe in it anymore. And I'm even anti-communist. At this particular point, because they would say, well, fine, that's all well and good, but who was in the Communist Party with you and who attended this meeting and that meeting? So as I say, they, you know, since that was never an issue for me, I knew I wasn't going to rat out anybody else. And because I always thought that that was not a, you know, a political question, naming names. It was a question of morality, essentially. So I never, you know, I never had any doubts. The only doubts that I ever had was I didn't know if I were called before a committee whether I would take the Fifth Amendment and not refuse to answer, or I would risk contempt by saying, okay, I'll tell you whatever you want to know about myself since I'm not ashamed of it, and but I won't name anybody else. And fortunately that I didn't have to face that. I was never called.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that was, you know, and I thought what the committee was doing was contemptible, and I didn't want to cooperate with it in any kind of way. So you never really tempted.
Yeah, you continue to work on Danger, though. Charles Russell came up with a pseudonym for you, right?
Well, yeah, I wrote, under a pseudonym for a while, and then the studio sort of, you know, there are blacklisted people out there, you know, who are doing this kind of underhand thing and using other names, and so they require that be a real person. They wanted to keep their own skirts clean.
Yeah.
And be able to say to a congressional committee that, you know, here he is, somebody without taint, you know, who we saw and is a live person and not a communist. So they insisted there be, you know, somebody show up who's real, so it became a question of finding fronts.
Yeah.
Somebody who would do that.
Tell us about some of the fronts that you had.
Well, it was always hard hanging on to, it was always hard finding them and then keeping them. I mean, there was one front, a woman who was the girlfriend of a musician whom I knew, and she had always wanted to be a writer, and so she volunteered to do it for me, and she took 25% of whatever it was that I made, and Russell at Danger knew about it, so she really didn't have to show up for any meetings or anything like that as long as she could be produced. And she was very happy that, you know, they did several shows under her name, and she got a certain amount of attention, and she was very pleased. She had some status, and it was going along, you know, very well. I would she would get the check and pay me 75% of it and keep 25%, and then she came around one time and said she couldn't do it anymore. Her analyst said it was bad for her ego. And she was very distraught and very angry at me because I had taken her into this privileged place, and then, you know, now she couldn't stay there any longer. And we had to cook up some story about why she couldn't do it anymore that would be satisfying to her and to her friends and believable. So we said there was she had suffered this mammoth writer's block. You know, that this happened to writers.
Of all the fronts you used, I think probably the most interesting was Leo. And, of course, I guess Leo was kind of the basis for the Woody Allen, I mean, more than the other composite.
In a way, yeah.
Tell us about Leo.
Well, Leo was a friend of a friend, and he was a gambler. And, you know, he loved to gamble. And, you know, like this woman before, you know, he had no politics particularly, but he was trying to improve his character, you know, and... so he thought this would be a good way of doing it. And he was great. I mean, he loved loved the gamble that was involved in it. And but there again, he'd been the sole support of his old mother and father. And he refused to take any money from me. He did it as a matter of principle, you know, that if he took money, it would be a bad show of character. And so his old parents started asking him for more money. And his friends kept saying, well, you know, they wanted to borrow money from him. They thought he was making all this money from the shows they saw his name on. and it became kind of intolerable for him. So he had to quit. And it was difficult hanging on to France.
Yeah. And you always had to come up with inventive ways of why this person, and of course they were so well written, other producers wanted to use these writers. I know under your pseudonym, Paul Bauman, other producers immediately came to you and said, hey, where's this Paul Bauman? We want to get him to write for our show.
Yes, well, before I had a front, when I had to use that pseudonym, there was a producer of a prominent CBS show called Studio One who kept calling Russell and saying, I want to use this writer. Where is he? And Russell had to come with inventive ways of saying he's not available. He lives out west, and he's very eccentric. And then afterward, he was in Switzerland recovering from some tropical disease. And the other producer got very angry because he thought Russell was holding out on him and trying to keep a writer for himself.
Today on Studio Tulsa, we're listening to a 1997 interview with screenwriter Walter Bernstein, the late Walter Bernstein, who died last week at the age of 101. Bernstein was nominated for an Oscar for his 1976 screenplay, The Front, which played on events from his own life as he was blacklisted through the 1950s. I spoke with him back on the publication of his memoir, Inside Out, a memoir of the blacklist.
One of the most poignant sections of the movie, The Front, which you wrote in, Martin Ritt directed, which is kind of based on your blacklisting days, has to do with Zero Mostel. And you were friends with Zero Mostel. He was in the movie, I believe the character's name was Hecky.
Is that right?
Yeah, Hecky. And this was a true story of going to the Catskills with Zero Mostel to perform at a Catskills resort and just seeing this. In the movie, it comes off as just this horrible anger that the character feels when the manager of the room says, I can't pay you what we said, I'm paying you less.
Yeah.
And there's nothing you can do about it because you're on the blacklist.
Yeah.
Well, that would happen.
Well, that was based on a true incident where Zero got he was out of work. It was much harder for the actors and directors than it was for the writers because he couldn't use a front, and he couldn't use a pseudonym, and he was having a tough time, and he got a call to do one night at this hotel in the Catskills called the Concord, and he had performed there, before he was blacklisted for, something like $3,000 a night, which was a great deal of money at that time, and the guy offered him $500, and he took it, he needed it, had to pay his rent, and I had a car at the time, and drove him up there, and he got there, and the manager said, well, gee, I'm sorry, it's only $250, and there's nothing he could do about it. He had to take the money. He needed it that badly, and he went on and performed, and it was a big crowd, about 1,500 people, 2,000 people, something like that, a big hall, and he did his act, this one-man act that he did, this comedy routine. And he was hilarious, and the audience just loved him, and he was in a rage, Zero, and he cursed at them, and he yelled at them, and screamed at them in Yiddish, and called them all kinds of terrible names, and trying to get off, get his rage out, and the more he did that, the more they loved him. They laughed, and they thought it was all part of the act, and it was just, he was in this terrible, terrible, frustrated rage, and he finished the act, and they kept calling him back, and he finally came off, and he just drank most of a bottle of whiskey. I remember sitting with him, and I put him to bed, and the next day we drove home, and I put that in the movie, that situation, except I wanted him to do it as it had appeared, as it had actually happened. I thought that moment would be devastating on the screen to see him doing the act and yelling at the audience, and they're just laughing while he can't get off. And he just refused to do it. I mean, it was still 20 years later. It was still, too painful for him to recreate.
Yeah. How much contact was there in the community of blacklisted writers, actors, when you were in New York? You write of people who weren't on the blacklist walking across streets to avoid bumping into you, even.
Mm-hmm.
But how much contact between this community of artists?
Well, there was a lot. I mean, it was very supportive. I mean, we saw a great deal of each other. We were kind of thrown together out of necessity, really. We helped each other. For example, if we heard of jobs that they were around, we would, you know, call people up and tell them about it. If I needed help on a script, for example, I know there were people I could call on who would selflessly help me with it. And that support was enormously important toward our survival, I think, because there was a great deal of generosity. If somebody was really desperate for money, we would try to pool what we had and give it, not lend it, and just give it to whoever needed it. And it was very, very important to me, I know, in that time, to know that there were people who could be that caring and that generous, even though they were in the same boat, or maybe because they were in the same boat.
I know you and writers Arnold Manoff and Abraham Polansky pretty much banded together in writing scripts under fronts and wrote the series. You were there in the mid-50s at the height of the blacklist under fronts,
mm-hmm.
and were tackling all these issues that were, of course, receiving raves, but constantly attacking what was happening in this country, you know, civil liberties issues. Tell us about you were
well,
you
it was
there.
A, you know, it was a very successful show at CBS. Sidney Lumet directed it. Charles Russell produced it, and it was written mostly for the first few years before it moved to Hollywood by Polansky and Manoff and myself. And we tackled all kinds of subjects. We did Galileo, and we did John Milton, and we did, as you said, big issues of civil liberties. And at a time when, you know, the whole McCarthy thing was really riding very high. As a matter of fact, at one point, Ed Murrow pulled Russell aside up at CBS and said, "How are you getting away with this?" And I don't know how we did get away with it, except the show was very successful. It won a lot of prizes, and there were constant calls from schools wanting to use it in their curriculum. And, you know, we wrote it under these various fronts.
Yeah. How did the era of blacklisting end for you?
Well, the blacklist was starting to crumble. I mean, I think Dalton Trumbo had been a prominent Hollywood screenwriter, one of the Hollywood Ten who had gone to jail. He got a job, I think Kirk Douglas hired him, and then Otto Preminger under his own name. So it was beginning to crack at that particular time, and Sidney Lumet had gotten a job to direct a film for Sophia Loren, and they needed a screenwriter for it, and he recommended me to Loren's husband, Carlo Ponti, who was producing it, and Ponti was Italian and, you know, didn't know or care what was happening in this country particularly, hired me, and much to my surprise, nobody objected, and I started working under my own name. It's a movie called That Kind of Woman.
Mm-hmm. Of course, later you did the film, which is nominated for Academy Award, The Front, which really featured a whole cast, writers, crew of blacklisted performers. How sweet was that? I mean, obviously you're telling the story as a comedy as opposed to the tragedy it really was, but how sweet was it to participate in that motion picture?
Well, first of all, even though it was a comedy, you know, it was a serious picture.
Yes.
We did consider it serious. It wasn't the kind of movie that we had started out doing or that we wanted to do initially, which was just a straight dramatic story of somebody who's blacklisted. But in certain ways, maybe it was a better way to approach the subject. And we couldn't get it done that first way. The only way we could get it done was to do it as a comedy. But it was, you know, it was enormously satisfying to be able to do it, to be able to hire people whom we knew who had been blacklisted also, and to put our names on it and say, this is, you know, we're still here. Mm-hmm. You didn't get rid of us, and we're still here, and we're doing the kind of work that we want to do.
Yeah, and I guess, would you consider yourself one of the lucky ones, a person who survived the blacklist?
I think I was very lucky. I was very lucky in a number of respects. I was lucky because I did survive as a writer. You know, a lot of people in the blacklist, even if they did survive, did survive by taking jobs as cab drivers or salesmen or whatever, not things that they were trained to do and what had been their life's work. And I was able to continue as a writer. And I was lucky in being able to have the friends that I did and to find new friends in a situation I possibly never, you know, would have before. I mean, I exist in a very dog-eat-dog business, movie business, or the television business. You're alone most of the time. In this way, I found a great deal of joy and support in other people and in a community, and I was very lucky that way.
Yeah. You write in the book of a very poignant scene of another writer, Ben Maddow.
Yes.
Who was blacklisted, eventually gave in and named names. I know, Elia Kazan, the same way. There's for people who participated in that, there's been no forgiveness, reconciliation. To those who did inform, who were your friends, have you talked with them since, or was it a complete cutoff? And why was it a complete cutoff?
Well, it was a complete cutoff, I think, because we felt that these people had betrayed us, had betrayed what they had stood for, had hurt people very, very badly, and some of those people had been their friends. Again, what I said before, it's one thing to say, okay, I don't believe in these things anymore that I believed in, but you were turning in other people for your own survival, for your own security, and we felt it was a really a despicable thing to have done at the time, to do that and to sacrifice other people, you know, for yourself. And feelings ran very high, you know. But that was 40 years ago, and there are people, you know, whom I didn't talk to 40 years ago, whom I meet now and say hello to, and I'm not terribly friendly with them. I mean, I don't see them socially particularly, but there's one person, you know, whom I've been active with and other capacities, whom I see at meetings, and we say hello, we talk, and then we each go our own way.
Mm-hmm.
So it also depended on what your personal relationship was with someone, I think, as to whether you feel forgiving enough. But at the time, you know, it was a very tense, difficult time. People were going under. And these people who named names just helped push them under some more.
The late screenwriter Walter Bernstein speaking with us back in 1997 upon the publication of his memoir, Inside Out, a memoir of the blacklist. Bernstein died last week at the age of 101. He was nominated for an Oscar for his screenplay The Front, which played on events from his own life when he was blacklisted in the 1950s. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.